Hello, everyone, and welcome. This is the Happy Warrior Podcast. In today's episode, it's the Revenge of the Swamp. It's pretty much a done deal. It's going to be President Biden, and his transition team has announced support for figures who are more swampy and blobby and establishment-y and far left as any were in the Obama White House. We will then jump into the disturbing situation as we are seeing increased ever more big tech censorship and the sadly growing desire from the left that there must be retribution for the Trump administration and everyone that supported him. And then finally, we will talk about my newest expose for the post-millennial about video game addiction. Always entertaining, always enlightening, so get comfy, pull up your favorite chair, put on your seatbelt, and let's have ourselves a podcast.
The Happy Warrior Podcast, conservative commentary on the news of the day from a more positive perspective.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back. It is so good to be back here at the mic with all of you, my good friends. I've been struggling with some health issues as of late, so it feels really good to be back here at the microphone with all of you. On the last episode of the Happy Warrior Podcast, I know I made a lot of people who are fans of my show and also Trump supporters, and even my own mom chewed me out after I recorded that last one, and they were very mad at me because I said that this litigation election strategy was not going to work. That was over a week ago. I got all kinds of hate from people on social media, and I have to say that I've been largely vindicated. And that's because I stuck to the truth and my understanding of where things were going, even when they might be going away, I don't like them. And I told you guys as much. Since I last spoke with you, there's been a lot of hubbub about Sidney Powell and are members of the Trump litigation team saying the truth? Are they a bunch of conspiracy theorists? In short, the litigation team for the Trump administration has pretty much been a clusterfuck all the way. The Trump administration has not been well served, but a big problem of this was they weren't well prepared for the legal fight before the election. That was the time when you needed to do things to prevent things like voter fraud, because we live in a secret ballot system. If it did happen, there's not a lot you can do afterwards. Remember, you have to convince judges with evidence to add ballots that weren't counted to the rolls. And on top of that, the Trump administration to win these states would have to then convince judges to overturn the states voting completely. And as I've shared on Twitter, more judges are like Supreme Court Justice John Roberts than not. They are aware of the national mood. They are aware of what the media will say about them, and it does influence them a lot. So the Trump administration trying to use litigation to overturn this election was likely never going to work, especially when they got started this late in the game. Now, all that is pretty obvious right now. The Trump administration kicked Sidney Powell out because she was basically being a conspiracy theorist. At least that's what they said. Rudy Giuliani's had to pull back a bunch of the language. The Trump administration is now allowing the intelligence transitioning for the Biden team. So the Biden team is now getting a lot of the intelligence information that Trump and Pence receive on a daily briefing. There are conservatives, special MAGA Trumpy people who are on social media saying, yep, this thing is done. Begin the Biden transition. So this thing is it's basically done with. The only things we really have left with the litigation is that put pressures on the state. And this is what I've always hoped from the very beginning with this, is to put pressures on the state to institute things like voter ID and other measures to make sure ballots are verified and we don't get any more dead people voting. It's a stance where I'm neither with the biggest of the Trumpy people that they want me to say that this is a complete total fraud of an election and all the states must be overturned. And if they're not, this is defeating the Democratic will of the people. And it's not the other side either with the never Trumpers like my one of my heroes, Jonah Goldberg, who said Trump was trying to steal this election. And I've been on the fence the whole time, as I usually am, because my job is journalist. and I will tell you guys the truth. And that is more important than how I want things to turn out, how you want them to turn out. Okay, you're always better off with the truth, trying to have an understanding of the lay of the land, even if it's uncomfortable, especially when it's uncomfortable. The left doesn't have people that do this anymore. Okay, they don't exist. The right still does, and we need to make sure that we don't lose that capacity. So I will continue to use this podcast as a platform and all my work as a journalist to tell the truth, unpopular as it may be, with whoever. And you know that from my reporting for the Postmillennial and the Federalist. You've seen it with the podcast here, my YouTube. I tell you guys the truth as I understand it, and I give you my word, I will always try to do that. That's a Happy Warrior Podcast gold guarantee. There was some polling that was done this week that asked Democrats or Republicans their view of election fairness, and if this election was all above board. In 2016, there was a majority of Democrats that believed the 2016 election was bubkiss. I believe it was in the high 60s. And then they just did this, and now it's completely flipped. It's like only 18% of Democrats believe the 2020 election was illegitimate at all, and it's like 73% of Republicans. So everyone's just completely flipped. On some level, though, I think it is more useful to Republicans than Democrats, because Republicans want things like voter ID. If we feel an election is stolen, that doesn't tell us we should get rid of elections, right? That doesn't mean we should play games so that they're in our favor next time. What Republicans will do is saying, we need to make sure we have voter ID. We need to make sure that voter signature is allowed, that kind of thing. And so I think overall, this is still a positive, even if people's faith in the elections isn't in a very good place right now. At least that's my opinion of it. And there's still some litigation on the way with the Trump team. They're going to seek a second recount in Georgia, for example. We've seen during the first recount, some couple thousand GOP votes were added in there that got missed. So there has been positive things happening. And it's important that we don't lose sight of that. Okay, when you tell the truth, it means you need to keep things in context. And the context is, this Trump litigation overall has been a pretty good thing. Electoral corruption is just so heinous, and once it gets in a system, it's very hard to get rid of, which again is why I said, if you're worried about fraud, you got to do something before the election. And this pressure from the Trump team, from Republicans, they are now asking questions they should have asked 4 years ago. They should have really been working on it, and they're themes that we've talked a lot about here on the podcast. The role of big tech trying to interfere things, trying to stack the deck so it always helps the left. We are now seeing Republicans, GOP people, conservatives, ask this question. Many people who had been ignorant of the issue of big tech trying to mess with our democracy. So we are seeing some big changes there. Dr. Robert Epstein, who was able to do an analysis of this last election, found that probably 6 million votes were shifted by Google alone. That's a pretty big deal. There are also other questions being asked about the role of lawfare. The left has elevated lawfare to a new level. As Tucker Carlson pointed out just last night, one of the strongest movers for votes in the Republican Party for conservatives in the United States is the NRA. Now, some of us who wish the NRA was still just a Second Amendment organization, maybe not so happy with that, but he's right. And the Democrats, especially in New York and on the East Coast, made life a living hell for the NRA. So they were unable to put resources out there to get people out to vote. And this mattered, especially in a place like Pennsylvania. And so, my friends, even though Trump lost this thing, like I said last week, this was largely a red wave election. Since last week, we've now moved 3 House seats in California, with two of those with South Korean women, including a favorite of mine, Young Kim, who I am just a huge, huge fan of. You can go into my deep parts of this this show, maybe one of my first podcasts, I talked about Young Kim. She's an amazing woman, incredible life story. So excited for her to be a representative. So this election, if you take away the Trump part of it, was kick butt for freedom lovers. And so we shouldn't get too down in the dumps. We shouldn't forget that. The left, they're trying to make you think that they won this thing. They want you to be scared. We'll talk about some of their very evil strategies they are now planning to do with the Biden administration. Part of us, to stand for truth, to stand for liberty, means we're going to have to stay brave. We're going to have to not be afraid. We have to be strong. And so, you know, that's the role that we all have to take. So, yeah, the Trumpster lost. It sucks for many reasons, most of all because some extreme lefties are coming in and the swamp is coming back. But all in all, this election was a lot better than most people think. And I just want to remind you guys here at the beginning about that. And so we will move on to our first major segment today, which is the Return of the Swamp. Oh, alternative title, the Return of the Blob. The Blob, the Blob, the Blob. So we have had now 2.5 weeks of Biden transition team news. And transition teams are always interesting in American history. Some transition teams, they don't make much noise until right before they enter the White House. Other times, they announce what they're going to do every step of the way. The Trump administration was more like the former. In fact, there were some spots that weren't even filled until they came into office that had been announced. The Biden administration is the latter. The Biden administration is kind of doing even what the Obama administration did, was make big, bold pronouncements of what they're going to do before they get in there, which is an interesting difference between Democratic and Republican administrations. Anyhow, if you are a freedom lover, if you are someone that maybe you read something like The Bulwark, right, and you're or National Review, and you're a type of conservative, I have friends like this, who wants government to be effective, okay? They don't necessarily want a big government, but if there is government, they want it to work effectively. The Biden administration, the people they have announced, should make both those groups very unhappy. If you are interested in freedom, if you are interested in not losing the positive libertarian gains the Trump administration made, you know, like in the Middle East, the peace in the Middle East, or the issue of treaties have to be ratified by Congress and they should be respected as such, as the Trump administration did. If you are interested in the issue of gun rights or child rights for parents, adoptee rights, if you are worried about disability, the Biden administration has made announcements with officials that are pro-blob, they are pro-DC establishment, they are pro-big corporation, but they're also anti-liberty in some very key ways. So let's go through some of them here. Foreign policy will probably be the most distinct. Foreign policy was the area that the Trump administration was most popular with conservatives. Maybe his judicial appointments was more popular. But many people, even libertarian folks, folks at Reason, are pretty happy with President Trump. Even now, he's trying to get troops pulled out of Afghanistan and Iraq. So if you're an anti-war guy, you should be pretty happy with what they're doing. Well, Biden administration has made it pretty clear they are not going to be appointing the anti-war folks to the State Department. Now, this is something that we saw, you know, they are the neo-libs, okay, not neocons, but neo-libs, neoliberals. And they are the traditional swamp creatures that control these institutions. And they're the kind of people that the Trump administration was fighting so hard against to middling success. In some ways, they did amazing. But in other ways, like we're about to see, they failed. The person that the Biden administration appointed, who had a good sign for where the foreign policy goes, is Antony Blinken. They want him to be Secretary of State. Now, Antony Blinken is an Obama guy, and he is a member of the D.C. establishment through and through. Antony Blinken is the dude that Joe Biden is going to appoint to be a Secretary of State. We're pretty sure on that at this point. And he is the opposite of Mike Pompeo. He is the opposite of the Trump administration. The Trump administration's goal in foreign policy was largely to break away from established norms that hadn't been working for 50 years. You see this in the Middle East with Jerusalem. They say, oh, if you move it to Jerusalem, you know, if you move them to see Jerusalem, it's game over, man. Or if you, there'll be just too much attacks, too many terrorism, all the Middle East nations will hate you. And then Trump did it, and it turned out not to be true. In fact, most Middle East nations are like, they're kind of like, meh. Like, we really don't care, guys. Another one was, you know, the Palestinians. There was an understanding you had to work with the Palestinians. That was the key to peace in the Middle East. It wasn't with the Israelis. It was with the Palestinians. Well, the Trump administration, under Mike Pompeo and others, took a new view. And they say, you know what? Why not peace in the Middle East? Why do we have to worry about bartering with these terrorists at the PLO? And the strategy has worked. Some people say the strategy works because it's people feel that the Trump administration is moving away from the Obama establishment. So places like Jordan feel like they have to make sure that they have their own foreign policy in case the America is unreliable. I don't know if that's necessarily true, but that's the major alternative theory. Anyhow, the Trump administration did stuff like that. Well, the Biden administration is going to go back to the established norms, even if they don't work, even if they put our freedoms or our trade at risk. So if you're a China hawk, you might be a little concerned. Anthony Blinken, even in his heart, is a swamp creature, okay? The guy, so Mike Pompeo was kind of a redneck military conservative radio station kind of guy. Blinken is an international kind of State Department slug. He grew up, get this, at a school in Paris. He went to a Parisian school as a kid. He plays the guitar, even has two singles on Spotify titled Lip Service and Patience. he jokes about going every week to play a soccer game with other U.S. officials, foreign diplomats, and journalists. I'm getting this information, by the way, from National Review, from a David Hursiani article, especially titled Biden's Cabinet, The Return of the Blob. So Blinken was a national security advisor for the Barack Obama administration. And this is objectively true. On every single foreign policy issue that Blinken has put out an opinion on, he has ended up being catastrophically wrong. And only in Washington, D.C. can you be wrong at every single thing and fail upwards into a cushier job. Blinken was one of these guys that spoke out against moving the Jerusalem embassy. Blinken was one of these guys that said the only way through peace is with the Palestinians. Blinken's opinion on the issue of the Russia led to that reset button fiasco. And it was also Blinken who supported the Iran deal, which has just been a complete menace, especially now that we're looking at Iran as being very close to obtaining and developing a nuclear weapon. Even on stuff for the war on terror, Blinken has all of it wrong. He admits that he pushed the Obama-Syria policy, which led to a genocidal disaster of epic proportions. He was against the Iraq surge. David Hursiani puts it in this way, okay? Blinken was wrong about Israel. He was wrong about the Palestinians. He was wrong about the prospects of peace. He was wrong about Iraq. He was wrong on Iran. He was wrong on Syria. He was wrong on Russia. He was wrong on Libya. He was wrong on China. And by the way, this is the one I'm most worried about with Blinken. If you ever failed as much at your job, you wouldn't have one. In Washington, you get to run the place. From this announcement of Blinken, you can safely say that on foreign policy, this will be the third term of the Obama administration and all the problems that came with that. The Obama administration was a disaster on foreign policy. Okay, that's hardly an opinion. That's almost a fact. They were, for example, complete softies on the issue of the Chinese Communist Party, and they weakened our position with them. I mean, they were wrong in the Middle East. They were starting wars left and right, kicking out dictators, and then only to be replaced with even worse tyrants, even worse economies, and civil rights for those people. You get the sense from Blinken's appointment that we are going to see a lot of Washington swamp kind of thinking run this administration. Some of the other appointments they've announced, for example, former Fed Chair Janet Yellen has been announced to be the Treasury Secretary, to the detriment of Elizabeth Warren, who had been jostling for the job. Some of the other appointments are pretty worrisome. For example, and this, if you're a disabled person like myself, this should bother you. Biden's official coronavirus advisor, this is going to be the person who will likely be in charge of lockdown policies. Part of Joe Biden's, quote, public health advisory committee, unquote. Joe Biden appointed eugenicist, bioethicist Ezekiel Emanuel And I might have mentioned this guy before in a previous episode of the podcast, but he is a believer in the idea that no one should live past age 75, which is just hilarious considering the guy he's going to work for just turned 78. But I mean, this guy is a madman, and he's going to be in charge of the coronavirus policy at the Biden White House. Another swamp creature you probably heard about is the climate czar is going to be John Kerry. Yes, John Kerry. He is going to, another one of these guys that feels upward. He was a terrible Secretary of State. He was just gosh awful at that job. And now he's going to be the climate czar. And we already have heard that many of his policy goals fall in line with the Great Reset. So that will be just wonderful, just lovely. And you can tell from the Kerry appointment that the Biden administration isn't only going to be swamp. It's going to be swamp. It's going to be blob. But it will be far to the left of the Obama administration in some significant ways. For example, his pick to be the head of the Director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines, is someone that once argued that the refusal to accept refugees in significant numbers posed a long-term threat to national security. This is a person that advocated for extreme immigration policy. And it isn't just far lefty and swampy appointments that should make us concerned about what the Biden administration is going to be. For example, Biden's team has already put out that they are going to support a gun registration scheme out of Congress that would cost firearm owners literally billions. Part of this plan would be to charge gun owners $200 per firearm owned. The Biden administration would also like some kind of public registry so they know all the guns that are owned by individuals in the United States. This plan largely hinges on support of Congress to pass such legislation, although I imagine they will try to do a lot using the power of executive orders, which remind you, all of you, that this election in Georgia, the runoff election, is so important because if the Democrats are able to win over the Senate, they will support things like this. The sense I get from reading on this subject and seeing these appointments and policy agendas outlined is the sense that the Biden administration will have some swampy people in it, but its official stance will be far to the left of even where the Obama administration was. Now, it's entirely possible that after these appointments and this first initial plan, the Biden administration starts its term off and the Republicans hold on to the Senate, and then that just guts a lot of what the Biden administration wants to do. That would, by the way, be a very good thing. And at that point, maybe the Biden administration changes course and does what Clinton did, which was to acknowledge a divided Congress and acknowledge that if Clinton wanted to get policy through, wanted to have legislation happen, he had to play ball with the GOP. And we could see that happening potentially. I'm not saying it will happen, but it is a potential outcome. All in all, the Biden administration is looking to be a formidable disaster for those who are concerned about losing the gains we've made under the Trump administration years. And I am not comfortable saying that a Biden administration would say no to things that are outlined in huge reworking kind of policy goals like the Great Reset. I don't have a strong sense that the Biden White House, especially with a president like Joe Biden, would be able to say no to the very worst ideas of the far left. That is the situation that will be facing us now in January once Joe Biden becomes president of the United States of America. And that, of course, will mean that all of us need to pay attention, that need to recognize when the Biden administration has gone to that far left, when they have done things that are morally wrong, that are against our democratic republican principles and the Constitution, and we'll have to speak up and be strong against it. Not in the way that Dems were against Trump and the Republicans over the last 4 years, where they tried to stack things where they act as crazy as they could, but we do need to stand strong and point out when the Biden administration colors outside of the lines. And so that will be a big part of the next 4 years. We'll be watching the Biden administration and pushing back against its worst tendencies. And hopefully that will make a big difference. But, you know, there's nothing you really can do against the issue of the executive orders. And there is major pressure on the Biden White House from a lot of the big brains at the newspapers and so on, that Biden just go all out with executive orders. And that could do immense damage. So, yeah, we have a big fight ahead of us with the Biden White House. I know I'm up for the fight. I know you guys are up for the fight. So let's bring this thing on. All right, stop right here. Be right back in a bit. We are back. Since the election, we have seen an unprecedented amount of naked, very blatant, really open about it, censorship of conservative and libertarian thinkers. Just today, YouTube announced that they were demonetizing One America News Network, OANN. It's the very Trumpy news service. President Trump likes it a whole lot. And they have been demonetized and banned from uploading and live streaming for 1 week. Their sin was that they posted COVID-19 misinformation. In YouTube's eyes, anything that goes against what the World Health Organization says is misinformation. This is, by the way, the same view at Twitter and Facebook. And so OANN had to go because it put up any skepticism regarding COVID-19. This has been a problem since the beginning of this lockdown back in February and March, was that the issue of COVID-19 being such a highly contested issue is not one and done. There are many parts of the science that are much debated. We are getting new reports all the time. We just had another one, a series of studies that found that, you know, lockdowns weren't very effective. There are others that say perhaps masks might not be doing much. The Wall Street Journal, when they wanted to do a meta-analysis of this information, found that masks made a difference in the rate of coronavirus. So the rate that people are getting sick with, you know, everyone using masks, that made a difference of 2%. Two, not 20, not 50, not 80, two. And there are multiple studies that say that masks have limited efficacy, that the lockdown has limited efficacy. The problem is, all this is a fine thing to debate about. We should be allowed to debate it. But if you do, on social media, that is a great way to get yourself banned. But as you are probably aware, if you are a conservative trying to use Facebook or Twitter, there has been a huge amount of censorship and algorithm issues since right before the election, but especially after it. For every conservative I know on Twitter has been losing followers left and right. News outlets that roll conservative have reported highly much reduced traffic. In particular, Breitbart. Breitbart is one of them that looked into this, and they found that all their web pages went down in traffic significantly following the election. But guess whose traffic went up? You know, these are the people that the social media are feeding users to. Well, CNN and other establishment media like the New York Times, MSNBC. Just today, the New York Times had a big opinion piece called Facebook Struggles to Balance Civility and Growth. And they frame a really bit of scary news. And here's the nugget. Here's the news nugget. Facebook has made an open choice to hurt the traffic, the influence, the ability of conservative and non-authoritative websites. And just so happens that most non-authoritative tend to be not mainstream, or they tend to have a different political perspective. And this article tried to frame it as, this is just Facebook. You know, they're just trying to balance civility with growth. This has to happen. They have to do this because we want a healthy nation. And we're seeing this kind of attitude when it comes to social media and the ability of especially conservatives, but, you know, some libertarians, heterodox thinkers, classic libs, when they want to have an engagement with social media and have growth, they are finding that lately it has got worse than ever. Now, in this article at the New York Times, Facebook says what they are doing, they don't plan to make it permanent, but I have my doubts, as you probably should too. I can safely warn you guys that the censorship we will see will be similar under this vein. It will become more hostile and more open, and will be based on the idea that they have to do this for national security and for safety. I know this because look up Parler and read all the news articles from the Washington Post, from the New York Times, from CNN, where they say that people who use Parler are dangerous, that Parler needs to be taken down because it's enabling, you know, hate crimes, et cetera, et cetera. Parler, which we are on, by the way, at Happy Warrior P, is alternative Twitter, right? It's not particularly dangerous. It doesn't even allow nudity. But because it is the alternative to the big social media, the left is having none of it. No alternatives can be brooked, okay? This is the open secret about our current situation with big tech and the media. You are not allowed to go to an alternative social media. You are not allowed to have your own website, okay? This is the story over and over again. The people at Gab say, we are going to make a social media alternative. Then they get letters and phone calls from MasterCard, from PayPal, who's saying, we're dropping you. Not only are we dropping you, we're going to ban your website from financial transactions and all the family members of the owners of Gab from being able to make financial transactions. This is the story that's told over and over and over again. They say, well, Twitter and Facebook, they're privately owned. You have nowhere to complain about this, conservatives. You guys, you'd have no right to tell a private entity what it can or cannot do, and you have no right to expect these private entities to act better. And if you don't like it, this is what's predicated upon, you could just go elsewhere. Go start your own. But here's the sad story. Like we've learned with the NRA in New York, where Democrats did weaponize the legal system against it. They will not allow alternatives to be brooked. They will not allow an alternative Twitter to grow. They will not allow an alternative to Facebook to appear. They will not allow BitChute to become a YouTube alternative. Not that it could, but they won't let it, even on that slim possibility. They will not allow you to go somewhere else. And if you do, they will call you a hater. They will run a series of articles advocating that website be shut down permanently, and all the bad people be pushed off the internet. We are seeing that right now for daily from CNN, especially people like Brian Stelter. They do not want anyone that is not 110% lockstep with the far left and the establishment's agenda. And if you are against it anyway, they will become, during this administration, during these next few years, more and more blatant about it. I will even go so far as to say as they will take down some really big names, some really big conservative or classic lib websites, and that will be the end of them. They are already trying to do it right now. Google is trying to kill off Breitbart. We now know that for a fact. They have used all their powers to turn down the traffic to conservative websites. The Trumpier, the less traffic. They are really, truly, honestly trying to kill off the conservative political movement. And so this is only going to get so much worse over the next 4 years. And this is one of those things that makes me sad that a Trump administration won't be here, because I don't like Trump. But I understood that if he wasn't the next guy in power, that we would come in with people who would support this agenda to kick everybody off, demonetize, etc. And I know to my libertarian friends, I'm a conservatarian. I'm a libertarian and a conservative. I like the libertarian policy ideas. I like the conservative philosophy. That's me. They say, Peter, you're going too far, man. You're going too far. You know, because I believe in economics. I believe in freedom. I honestly do not know what the solution is to all of this stuff, because I know government usually makes everything worse. I'm a Hayekian that way. But just because we don't want government to be the solution doesn't mean a problem cannot exist. Okay, we need to recognize that big tech is a very big problem. I don't know what the solution to that is. Alan Bakari, who we had on, the great tech reporter, investigative reporter, he thinks that we need to reform Section 230, change it in a fundamental way. But there are others that say if we do this, that could destroy the free internet and make everything worse. There are good arguments that are very compelling on both sides. And I don't know what the answer to it is. But what I do know is that our opportunity to do something about it has largely passed. And we will now have to try to survive the next 4 years. I mean, there is talk that major personalities, okay, places like the Daily Wire, places like The Blaze, that there will be a concerted effort to take those places down per memento. That is not hyperbole. There is a major concern from people. Glenn Beck, he'd say that he would not be surprised if it was the turn of the Fairness Doctrine. So things might get really sketchy these next 4 years. And if I'm being too bombastic, I'm being too big about my approach, I hope I'm wrong. But as your humble journalist that is reading the tea leaves, feeling where the wind is blowing, reading what is happening with the metrics that these websites are reporting, things are going to get a lot worse when it comes to freedom of speech and big tech censorship. And I pray to God I'm wrong, but my understanding and study of the issue, that is the direction we are headed. And what we can do about that, I don't know. But definitely support alternative websites. Definitely, definitely support them. If we are to see any kind of big tech reform in the next 4 years, it will almost certainly be antitrust, and it will almost certainly make the situation much, much worse. Here's the truth of the matter, my friends. There are two cultures in the United States at the moment. We used to be, 30 years ago, one culture when it came to freedom of speech, and that was, it's a good thing. Now we are divided on the issue. On one, you see this at the antitrust tech hearings. You'll have senators like Ted Cruz are saying, you guys are censoring too much. You're doing too much. And then the turn will move to the Democrats and the tech committee, and people like Dick Blumenthal, Mazie Hirono, they will say, actually, Facebook, why aren't you censoring conservatives more? The problem is not that there's too much censorship. The problem is there's not enough. A great example of this is Senator Chris Coons just last week, who gets in a discussion with Jack Dorsey and Mark Zuckerberg, and he advocates that social media must be more proactive to censor speech that they don't like. The example he uses here is climate denialism. It's some pretty interesting stuff. Take a listen.
Well, Mr. Dorsey, and I'll close with this. I cannot think of a greater harm than climate change, which is transforming literally our planet and causing harm to our entire world. I think we're experiencing significant harm as we speak. I recognize the pandemic and misinformation about COVID-19, manipulated media also cause harm, but I'd urge you to reconsider that, because helping to disseminate climate denialism, in my view, further facilitates and accelerates one of the greatest existential threats to our world.
So there you have it. Senator Chris Coons asking, why haven't you guys censored more? It is my opinion that the fight over the next 4 years for freedom against tech censorship is only going to get much worse. At the same time, we are going to see more support for ideas that we are seeing like in China and the UK. China is pushing for the world to institute a social credit system. And one of their ideas is that everyone will have a barcode that will say what their coronavirus test results are in their general health. And they would have to have this if they want to travel anywhere. The UK is doing something similar. They are referring to their program as a freedom pass, but it's very similar. Same idea. You have to be tested for COVID-19. You will get a certain color rating on your likelihood of being infected, and unless you meet a certain threshold, you will not be allowed to travel, participate, go to the local Boxing Day celebration, etc. we are going to see big government, big tech ideas like this being pushed more and more. At first, it will be under the cover of the coronavirus, and after that, your guess is as good as mine. But these are big issues with tech we are going to be seeing over the next 4 years, and I really do hope I have this wrong. The current culture, the current climate, the current mood of the left is that what happened these last 4 years has to be prosecuted. There has to be a punishment for allowing the Trump administration and everything that goes with it exist. You are seeing big wig pieces at the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Nation, Time, and elsewhere. And the general vibe is that the President Trump and his administration should be made to be punished in some way. Ideas we've seen are things from former Labor Secretary Robert Reich. There needs to be a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We are seeing opinions like, you know, what are we going to do with all these terrible Republicans and Trump supporters? Here's a few examples of the kind of thing I'm seeing on social media and in the media. Here's one from a writer, a critic for the New York Times, Jerry Saltz. Republicanism is no longer a political problem. Republicanism is a social problem. It must be treated in the same way coronavirus is treated. It has to be isolated and snuffed out by repressing it in about 70% of the general population, which that's pretty scary. Here's another one. This is from writer David Atkins. He put, "No, seriously, how do you deprogram 75 million people? Where do you start? Fox? Facebook? We have to start thinking in terms of post-World War II Germany or Japan, or the failures of Reconstruction in the South." And it goes on. "This is not your standard partisan policy disagreement. This is a conspiracy theory-fueled belligerent death cult against reality and basic decency. The only actual policy debates of note are happening within the Dem coalition between the left and center-left." And it goes on for quite a while. It's a long rant. Here's another Hollywood director and producer, Rob Reiner, calling for a nonpartisan investigation once Trump comes out of office. Here are a few examples of big think pieces we are seeing all over the place. Washington Post, yes, the Biden administration should hold Trump accountable. CNN, this is hold President Trump accountable for his misdeeds. This is from the Boston Globe. If Biden wants unity, he must first hold Trump accountable. This is from the New York Times. After Trump, America needs accountability for his corruption. The New Yorker, why Trump can't afford to lose, where they go into a long thing about if Trump loses this thing, he will be prosecuted. Vanity Fair had a similar piece, and on and on. President Barack Obama has now compared Trump to a dictator who suppressed journalists, which ironically is because the Obama administration, if you remember, the AP came out against the Obama administration for jailing journalists and just being nasty left and right when it came to press freedom. This is not a crazy idea. Okay, it is a crazy idea, but it's not crazy to see people actually going forward. There is a desire from the far left for a punishment for Trump and his supporters. This is a real thing, and this is an extremely worrisome tendency that I hope the Biden administration will not feed. And it will be the first major test of Joe Biden's character as President of the United States, if he will feed this or not. If he feeds it, we are in danger of becoming a banana republic. If we allow the Trump administration, there are lawyers right now, there are AGs and the rest going on right now in New York, having investigations going on. They are waiting for the okay. They want Trump in chains. They want him in jail. They want him in prison. They want members of his administration to never be able to hold a job anywhere. We've now had people at Harvard say that all people who worked in the Trump administration should not be able to be seen in polite society again. This is happening. This is a destructive tendency that, if fed, would destroy this country. You cannot exist like this and still be a free republic. We do not do that in this country, okay? Part of the transfer power isn't just the guy in the White House letting the next guy control. It's also population being able to forgive the changes in the mood of the electorate. Okay? When the opioid prohibition ends, if the people with chronic pain said, okay, all of you that made our life heck, you now all have to suffer. So we are going to withdraw health care for anyone that worked in law enforcement, anyone that worked at DEA, anyone that made it so we could not have the pain medicine we need to live. Okay, people had died. People have died. And it's partially your fault. If we demanded that at that point and we made it legal reality, we would be no better than the people that put us in this situation. It would be so destructive to the fabric of the country, destructive to rule of law. It would be foolishness. Now, it would seem like the natural consequence, right? You know, our human monkey, natural man side, we would feel that this was the right thing, you know, eye for an eye. But you see how that would perpetuate a cycle of destruction and violence. So it's very important that we don't feed these tendencies that are inside of us. Okay, when we lose political discussions, when we lose political arguments and the electorate moves on to the next guy, it's important we don't do what the Dems did this last 4 years, and very important to what there are some pushing for very strongly. And it is cancel culture in its worst and most virulent form, and it is a danger. And I would ask you, as I often ask, to keep the country in your prayers and that people do not turn to this desire, because it does exist. I would also say Republicans, Trump supporters, do not do what the Dems have done the last 4 years. Do not try to impeach Biden, you know, try to create something so you can impeach him. Don't try to prosecute anyone that ever worked for him. Don't hound Dems in restaurants, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think you will, but that there is that tendency, you know, cycle of violence. I mean, you can, it's just human nature that you want to give as good as you got. And we need to fight those tendencies. We need to be better than that. You know, the founders made us a constitutional republic with questions that government could not mess with. And it wasn't just in theory, it was also in spirit and practice. And that means that we would inculcate in the population a certain morality, a certain understanding of forgiveness and acceptance so that we could continue on as a nation. Because if we try to destroy each other every time there's a change of the guy in the White House, we wouldn't have made it 10 years, let alone 200. So this is something that I'm seeing, and I include this in the segment with big tech censorship because it's the same vein of feeling. It is this feeling you have to punish the other side and you must use everything at your disposal to do it. And both are extremely dangerous. And as someone that's trying to continue this country to be in its greatest health and the best outcome for its populace, we at the Happy Warrior Podcast are strongly against all notions of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission and throwing the president in chains. Okay, I'll end it here for this segment. Many people were very mad with Gerald Ford when he pardoned Richard Nixon. Pollsters have looked at this. They've studied it out. Ford actually had a popular support until this moment. He comes in and people were willing to give Ford a shake. Ford does this, and people at the time felt that he just threw away his chance to be president, because how could he ask the country to forgive Nixon? Now, Ford did this because he understood what I just told you about, that a country is more than just the laws and the books. A country is more than your constitution. It's more than the Bill of Rights. Because besides there being a physical element of a country, there is a spiritual, there is a moral fiber, and that must be protected at all costs. That must be inculcated and defended and grown. And he did not want the United States of America to lose that. If Nixon had gone to prison, if Nixon was put in chains, that would have broken something in us, or at least that's how Ford felt about it. I think he was probably right, because it was really important that we do not become that kind of country. Well, we're at that crossroads again. Now, this time, no one's broken the law, or at least as far as we can tell, but it's a similar notion. We have to fight the desire of hate and revenge. Okay, both sides. The left has to forgive the Trump administration. Conservatives and people on the right need to try to have patience with this next one and fight it on constitutional grounds. You know, fight them the way we wish the Dems had behaved the last 4 years. It's going to be hard. And so please do what you can, you know, in your own small way and encourage in your leaders. But this tendency of ours that has grown, you know, eye for an eye, no bars hold, is so dangerous and such a concern. And we will see a lot of this the next 4 years. And it really will come down to, at least at first, the Biden administration and how they respond. And if Biden, and he says, yeah, let's do that. Truth and reconciliation, yeah. Yes, New York, continue your investigations into Trump. He fails his moral test as president. And I don't know if, I mean, you do that in my eyes, in the terms of history, future generations will curse your name. You do not come back from that. So keep Mr. President Biden in your prayers. That he has enough faculties about him to recognize that. He started his career just as Watergate was happening, okay? So he is someone that should know the story well and should know to not fall into this trap that the radicals and on the left would have him go into. There's a lot of stuff facing us these next 4 years, and I don't blame you if you're not feeling super hopeful about it. I hope we will rise to our better natures. We'll listen to our angels. I don't think it's a one and done that things will be bad and horrible, but there is that potential there. And so we need to pay attention, keep the country in our prayers, try to persuade our fellow countrymen. And whenever the big tech, big corporation, government, whenever, whatever it is, when they go out of line, we have to point it out. And that will be the job once again, as it seems to always be. All right, well, we are going to take a break. I'm going to do our last segment here on the issue of video game addiction, which that was my latest expose for the post-millennial, which I'm more than happy to talk about in just a bit. Thank you for listening. This is the Happy Warrior Podcast. Let's take a break and come right back. Hello, friends. It is great to be back with you here today on the Happy Warrior Podcast. I'd like to talk to you guys about the subject of VGA, or video game addiction. As you are all well aware, this is a big month for video gamers. The PS5, PlayStation 5, and Xbox Series X, the next Xbox, have come out this month. Some major games have been recently released. You know, the next Assassin's Creed, Valhalla. The awesome Cold War, the next entry in the Call of Duty Modern Warfare series. There is a lot going on with video games right now. And this year in general has been amazing for the game industry. I mean, consider that before COVID happened, there are about 3 billion gamers worldwide. Every year, the game industry makes about $120 billion in revenue. That is more money than all of movies and TV combined. And with COVID, we have millions of new gamers, people who never gamed before. But many people, you know, you hear all these stories over the summer of people like getting into Animal Crossing that never played a video game before. And then we had all these stories, you know, during the election of the Biden administration comes out with their own Animal Crossing Island. Gaming right now is really big with movies not happening. People kind of tired of binging TV. Games are it, man. They are the medium of our time. And of course, with all that extra money and extra attention, there are of course plenty of organizations and news outlets who are making the case for things like video game addiction. People are into this, so there must be something wrong. Now, as you, my audience, are well aware, I consider myself a nerd of the highest order. My entry into nerddom as a kid was video games, especially the Super Nintendo, playing games like Super Mario Brothers, The Legend of Zelda, stuff like that is really how I got my start as a geek. I have always been kind of skeptical of VGA. I think very highly of gaming at times, I discovered as a high schooler how gaming could be more than just entertainment. It could be an art form. That's how we get the song that is the opening and closing of this podcast. I remember in the 2000s, there was a lot of talk about people becoming addicted to World of Warcraft. You still see it now and then. People just losing their lives playing this MMO, mass multiplayer online game. And I was very skeptical back then, as I am now. Well, for my newest expose for the post-millennial, I look into this. Is video game addiction real? Or as I put it, is video game addiction a thing? There are so many people right now pushing hard, especially governments, especially people in the news media, who are making strong cases that government regulation needs to happen because there is an out-of-control video game addiction afflicting people. And as someone that has covered a different addiction crisis, the opioid crisis, pretty thoroughly, I would like to get on top of this concept of addiction to something else, especially something that doesn't have a chemical component to it. So it is important that we define our terms before going forward, okay? In English, we like to use the term of addiction to just talk about things we have a habit of doing. We'll use, when we're talking about an addiction, sometimes we're only talking about a habit, or we're only talking about a one-time mistake, or it's something we just really enjoy. You say, I'm addicted to The Mandalorian, and you're not really addicted, you just really like this thing, and maybe you've watched a lot of it. But there is an actual term for addiction. It is a real thing. Addiction is defined as, in the medical terminology, repeating a compulsive behavior that seems rewarding but is ultimately detrimental. Or, in other words, you do stuff that hurts you and you cannot stop doing it. Addiction is essentially you engage with something, a chemical, a behavior, that seems to have some rewarding component to it. Maybe it's pleasurable. Maybe it relieves some stress or anxiety. Stuff like that. And even though it's kind of rewarding, it's ultimately detrimental, and you're stuck in it. You're stuck in a loop doing this over and over and over and over and over and over again. Consider drinking alcohol. You use alcohol one day because you're self-medicating with life stressors, maybe some mental illness, something's going on, and you do it, and it seems kind of rewarding. And, it hurts you, but you're like, this kind of made a difference, and you get stuck in it, and then you just keep doing it, and the detrimental side just gets worse and worse, and the rewarding part gets less and less. That is a classical understanding of what addiction is. Now, addiction does not have to be primarily chemical, like alcohol. It's well known. Certain behaviors, gambling, some sex addiction, that also crosses over some with pornography, but that's a little bit different. They have been long recognized as addictions. People who suffer behavioral addictions, those sufferers can face many of the same problems as, say, an alcoholic. You may miss large amounts of work. You may eschew life events in favor of feeding the addiction. person stuck in a behavioral addiction can end up unable to take care of themselves, stuck in loops of harmful behavior that they cannot shake themselves out of. Now that we have our terms established, let's move on to the major topic, VGA, video game addiction. There are essentially two major arguments, and then there's a third one about, is video game addiction real? If it is real, how should it be defined? Is it something by itself, or is it just a part of behavioral addiction generally? You may have heard or read that all the science is done. Video game addiction is totally a thing. That just isn't true. It is hotly, hotly debated. Even back 2013, the American Psychiatric Association found that there was insufficient evidence proving video game addiction was real, and instead encouraged more research. Last year, the World Health Organization controversially added gaming disorder to their ICD, the International Classification of Diseases, which is considered like the International DSM. That's used for diagnostics. The ever so reliable World Health Organization would, just this year, unironically, due to COVID, encourage everyone to start gaming, which seems awfully weird when you are just said the year before that people can become addicted, be exposed just by playing a video game. For this issue, there are two major schools of thought on it. The first are the skeptics. I contacted for this article, for example, here are two people. Andrew Przybylski, he is in charge of the Oxford Internet Institute. Also, someone I've worked with on a previous project before, Dr. Chris Ferguson of Stetson University. They are skeptical of video game addiction being its separate own thing. They, along with 26 others, when the World Health Organization was considering all this, wrote an open letter arguing that the available research on this topic is very muddled and that this would lead to a moral panic. I contacted these folks and went back and forth with Mr. Ferguson, and he told me that he has real concern that the field of psychiatry on this issue is just wrongheaded all the way. In his mind, the science isn't quite there. And he says that if we indulge this, we are indulging moral panic over games that could end up with parents making bad decisions. The parents will become hyper-focused on the gaming hours and the video game rather than investigating the underlying depression, anxiety that is the real issue. He's basically saying there that this would make people blame the game instead of your kid's depressed or your kid's being bullied, your kid has some mental health issue, and that would not get addressed. So your kid actually wouldn't get help. All you would have done is seem to deal with the external shell issue. Ferguson says VGA is not an addiction to itself. This is important. People like Chris Ferguson are not saying people aren't suffering. This is important. For the opioid crisis, you guys need to understand, just because we are saying that there is an important distinction here doesn't mean that people aren't suffering. But it's important that we define things correctly, right? Because if you give people the wrong information and the wrong premise, they will try to fix it, and the way they fix it will ultimately make people worse off. As I can publicly I'll put my hand on the Bible in court and I will testify that that is the truth. Ferguson says, you know, VGA is not addiction unto itself, but is part of a general compulsive behavior disorder. He's saying that people, we focus too much on things. Okay, people say, I have this kind of addiction, I have that kind of addiction. Where Ferguson's argument, and the people like him, arguing that actually there's just a general compulsive addiction disorder that people can get into, and it can be blamed on all kinds of things, including video games. It's addiction, in his mind, should be better understood as a pathology that's within the individual and not a feature of the technology or the media. The general understanding he's saying is, we have this backwards. We are putting the VGA cart before the behavioral horse. It isn't video games that are driving the addiction, but something that is within the person that is driving them to become addicted. If you look at addiction as being stuck in a negative series of behavior loops, then you understand why blaming an item, say video games, it doesn't really work, because often people will find some other thing to hurt themselves. You know, they'll get in some other kind of negative loop. They get out of one and maybe they'll fall into another. And then you have to ask, well, was this really about video game addiction at all? Maybe there's something wrong with this person. So that is the argument from people like the Oxford Internet Research Institute, people like Dr. Ferguson. That's the gist of their argument. On the other side of this discussion are people like Dr. Mark Griffiths. Dr. Mark Griffiths is known as the man with more papers published than just about anyone else living. He is a doctor at the University of Nottingham, Trent, and the director of the International Gaming Research Unit. And gaming in this case means gambling, slots, poker, etc. And he specializes primarily in gambling disorder. That's what he does. He has a 30-year record on the topic. No one has published more on the topic of gaming addiction than anyone else living, and that is a fact. He's a fascinating guy to talk to, and it would have had a heck of a time trying to figure out how to get a phone call to him on UK time from my central time. It was a pain in the keister. Dr. Mark Griffiths talked to me for about an hour, kind of annoyed, but you know, he told me that in his mind, the argument is video game addiction real? Is it a thing? Is it special to video games? He believes it totally is. He told me there are countless neurobiological studies right now. We have about 15 nationally represented epidemiological studies. There are hundreds of studies. The real big argument is to what extent prevalence of the problem is, Griffiths told me. Griffiths does believe, based on his research and working with people, that we have enough evidence at this point to say that there is something about video games that does lead some people to becoming addicted. Now, Dr. Mark Griffiths, being a real scientist, is someone that knows the research, and he moderates. He agrees with people like Chris Ferguson that the video game addiction pro side way overplays their hand. You will see this especially in the news media, and you will see this coming from places like South Korea or China, home to everyone's favorite control freaks. They'll say, well, 5%, 10% of gamers could become addicted. And he thinks this is bubkiss. He thinks about 1% or less of gamers likely are addicted. He feels that would be the accurate stat. And you know, that would fit what we know of addiction in general. According to the meta-analysis by people like Chris Ferguson, we believe that addiction in general, this is different than just an addictive personality disorder, but we believe about 3% of the general population are susceptible to things like addiction. And a 1% or less of gamers being addicted would fit inside of that. Now, that might seem low, 1% or less. But if you consider that there are about 244 million people gaming in the United States this year, that's amazing, by the way. That's just a stat I would never have believed even 10 years ago. That even at 1% means potentially 2.4 million people were struggling with a terrible addiction. Even if it's like 10%, you know, 10% of that, it's only 240,000 people. That's still a lot of people, and what they are going through is terrible, terrible suffering. Now, Ferguson, he also told me, and this is in the article, you know, we also kind of get a feeling this is a thing because we have these treatment clinics that deal with addiction popping up all over the world, not just for general addiction, which those already existed, but for video game addiction specifically. And these people, they'll come to, say, your general addiction center, and they say, video gaming has taken over my life. Going to Mr. Griffiths, I'll quote him directly. Quote, we're not just talking about the kind of 12 or 13-year-old adolescent sitting in his bedroom all day. We're talking about grown adults in their 30s or 40s where gaming has taken over their life, loss in their job, loss in their relationships, and they are doing it in neglect of everything else. Now, both sides of this argument are extremely compelling, and you could fall on either side of this scientific debate, and I think you would still be a scientist of merit. But after talking to Dr. Mark Griffiths, I wanted to find normies. I want to find some normal people that are dealing with this. So I put out a memo on my social media. I went to Reddit and Facebook gaming groups of different kinds. You know, I went to the Libertarian one, I went to this LDS one, I went to this general one, I went to this piece. It was all kinds, different kinds. It was a lot of work. And I asked, okay, do you guys have stories of struggling with video game addiction, or do you know someone that has? If it is true, it's 1% of gamers, then many of us likely know someone that is struggling with this. So after reaching out to people with the wonderful help of social media, I did some phone calls, I did some interviews. The stories that I found through my investigation were quite shocking. They're quite sobering. They stayed with me. They stayed with me. And it made me rethink my glib attitude about VGA. Here's some of the stories that were told to me. One man told me after the death of his stepfather, he kind of broke and he tried to cope using video games. And so he would game from when he got home from school. You know, he comes home from school about 3 or 4, and he would game until 5 or 6 a.m. the next day, get 2 hours of sleep, go to school, rinse and repeat. And he did this for a very long time. Another story, a woman, a divorcee, who herself is a gamer, told me the story of when her ex-husband became addicted to World of Warcraft, at least in her eyes, and he became more and more emotionally distant as time was more and more dedicated to WoW. And he began to act with very erratic behavior, and he began to have affairs, and all of this ended into a divorce. It was just a horrible, horrible mess. Some of these stories are quite hard. A property manager, I talked to this man on the phone for a while, he became a property manager after playing one of the Assassin's Creed games, Assassin's Creed 2, where you have to, one of the mini games of that title is you have to manage property. And he said that inspired him towards his career. He told me his frustrations, and he loves gaming, that some of his tenants, VGA seemed to be a thing that was really impacting them. He would have stories like, and he knew this elderly couple, that they have this apartment, and they are basically forced to work solely while their adult children will game all day, 24/7. And he saw enough of this frequently enough that it really stayed with him. And he told me that due to this experience, it so soured him to it that he feels like he should never introduce gaming to his kids because he does not want to risk video game addiction or screen addiction. He really felt quite strongly about this. Let's do one more story. This is in the article. Okay, I talked to this guy in my local area, really nice gentleman, Joseph Kratt, and he is also from the state of South Dakota. He told me about his own struggles with VGA and what he's witnessed, okay? He's not dissimilar to me. He got started gaming in the 90s. His first real entry into it was the Pokemon games, you know, Pokemon Red, Pokemon Blue on the Game Boy. Good times, good times. And, you know, he struggled as a teenager to balance schoolwork with video gaming and things he had to do for school, like marching band. But he didn't really have a problem. VGA didn't really, or his gaming amount didn't really become a problem until he was in college. And he told me that in college, the game Black Ops, Call of Duty Black Ops came out. Now I'm going to quote the guy. Call of Duty Black Ops came out when I was a freshman in college, and there were about 4 or 5 of us that would meet up online, and we would skip our classes, and we would just play COD all the time. And at the end of it, only one of us would graduate from college. The rest of us are dropouts. And his story is that in college, it became a major problem. It became a major consumer of his time. Now, as a fully-fledged adult, he is a responsible human being. He controls his gaming to be an hour or two a day. But what I found fascinating about Joseph's story is that he is no stranger to addiction or the concept of it. While he isn't a huge addict, he has friends and family that have substance abuse problems. And he does struggle with smoking, a terrible habit, very hard to quit. That's a kind of addiction, nicotine addiction. He noted that there are big similarities between video game addiction and the drug addiction. He noticed the similarities there that exist. And that was a frequent theme that I was told by people, was that there is something about this thing called video game addiction, if it's just the thing, that is so similar to substance abuse. And one of those things that I noticed, and I could apply my own history of family and friends that seem to struggle with something similar, was that often addiction is born from self-medicating. Self-medicating is the term that's used in drug treatment and law enforcement, and it's when people turn to drugs to deal with problems in their lives, often mental illness or some health problem, but also, bad job, poverty, stress, what have you. And gaming, when it became a problem, was often born out of real life problems. Listen to the stories I just shared with you. A woman whose stepfather dies. Okay, that would be a horrible thing, and you could find yourself trying to cope with that with extreme length of hours of video gaming. Right? That seems to make sense. I think most of us could understand how you get yourself in something like that. And with video gaming, whether it's a behavioral thing, whether it's just something that's wrong with you and so you engage in a bad behavior, or whether it's specific to video gaming that makes this temptation or issue worse, something is happening. Okay, this is where my investigation took me. There is something going on. I'm not sure if it's the video game specifically or not. There's some scientific evidence, this didn't make the article, that certain types of video games are more likely to be for addiction. MMOs are way up there. Decently up there are some mobile games. And for the people that approach video games, what they get out of it is different from person to person. So it's not an easy one and done, yes, they're addicted, no, they're not addicted thing. But something is happening. Whatever it is, there is something happening. So I decided to contact some more people. I got in contact with the guy that co-founded and runs Healthy Gamer. If you are someone that enjoys game streams, you may have seen him on stuff. His name is Dr. Krudi Kanogia. He's a Harvard-trained psychologist. And his claim to fame, besides running this video game treatment website, is that he does live therapy sessions with famous video game streamers and YouTubers online. And he talks about issues like video game addiction, dealing with depression, etc. Very nice gentleman. All the people I talked to are nice. I don't know why I say that. Dr. K told me, in his mind, he totally believes this is a thing. And he told me, quote, "The reason VGA is so problematic is because games fulfill certain psychological needs," unquote. We just talked about this. There's something happening here that people are turning to deal with things. He said, "People turn to video games as a coping mechanism for a lot of negative and common things in life. We work with a lot of people who started gaming as a result of being bullied in school or a parent's divorce or social anxiety, for example." Now, if you are struggling with what looks like to be a video game addiction in general, Dr. K's advice may help you. Remember, I am not a addiction doctor, so these are his words, not mine. According to Dr. K, the major trick to helping people find healing from this addiction, his extra oomph that really helps, is to help patients figure out what they are psychologically getting out of video games that is feeding their addiction. He told me, quote, some people, they game for 14 hours a day. At that point, they often say that video game isn't fun anymore. So people have to figure out what the game is doing for them. And this falls along with the general good advice given by people who specialize in addiction. I learned this covering the opioid crisis, is that the best way generally for people who are struggling with addiction is something called the multimodal approach. Now, it means a lot of things, but layman's, it means that you throw everything in the kitchen sink to try to deal with it. And you send a bunch of healthy treatments. So you'll have someone go through talk therapy. They'll be trained in cognitive behavioral therapy. There will likely be a pharmacological aspect to it. So ADHD medication, antidepressants, for example. And then you'll have maybe some other therapies in it as well. The general approach is you're trying to help someone to improve their overall life, and that will help them in getting to a healthier place. You know, exercise is a big part of that. Multimodal can mean a lot of things. It's much more complex than that. I am just doing a vast simplification of what that is, so you guys can have some clue as to what I'm talking about. Now, what is going on with VGA and the world governments? What can we expect now that we understand this issue? What is going to happen, though, with the world governments? Are they going to push some kind of policy? Is there going to be some kind of legislation in our future? As you guys have probably learned from now, because you're so smart, because you listen to this podcast, all my listeners are the smartest listeners. When there is an addiction crisis, there will inevitably be following newspapers and lawyers and world governments that want to solve it. And we are seeing that with this issue. Now, in the United States, in the West, we're not seeing as much, but we are seeing it in big places like South Korea, China, even Japan, where they have enacted policies aimed at dealing with VGA. Those policies usually are set limits, especially for teens and young children, to amount of gaming they can do a day. South Korea, they have nationwide legislation. China, they have nationwide stuff. Japan, it's stuck to one of the prefectures. I want to say Ryukyu, but I probably get that wrong. That's generally the kind of legislation you'll see deal with it. Say people can only game during this time or that time. They can only game a certain amount. In China, of course, we know that they're super duper controlling about what games are allowed to be published. Some of that might go with that too. What we've seen in the West for a corrective to the growth of video game addiction is largely due to the gambling aspects of gaming. We have seen in recent years, and it started in mobile, there are things like gacha games. And these games are literally designed to make their money by catching whales. How this works is you'll have a game like Rise of Kingdoms, Candy Crush to some extent too, where how they make their money is, for most people it's just free and they don't spend any money on it. But they are hoping that they can hook some suckers who will pay a couple hundred, couple thousand, 10,000 or more on this game. And they're referred to as whale-reliant games. Okay, these are games that are highly based on staggered chance, and they expect you to pay lots of money if you want to continue with the game. Unfortunately, we are now seeing this grow into some PC games and desktop games. And like Electronic Arts is like one of the worst offenders now of this. They're just adding gambling aspects, you know, loot boxes. I mean, come on. I mean, that's broad face. That looks like gambling. And they're adding this to their games. Now, these kind of things that look like gambling are getting pressure, mostly led by the United Kingdom. But we're seeing some, too, in Congress, complaints about this. And we are seeing some legislation being pushed in places like the United Kingdom against this kind of stuff in gaming. And I'm a libertarian. I think we should allow companies in general to do what they want to do, and then they'll have to deal with the consequences. But I can understand why you would not want that kind of stuff in video games, especially when children are involved. Now, to end this off, big picture, I don't know if video game addiction is a thing or not, or if it's just a general behavioral problem. What I do know is there is a small division of people that are stuck in these behavioral loops and are ruining their lives. And I feel just tremendous compassion for them. And I hope you guys will too. Now, should there be some kind of governmental overreach to try to solve this problem? I don't think so. I think that video game addiction is largely the same kind of issues we have every time there is a new technological platform and medium. We've had this problem since the printing press, which sparked terrible religious wars in Europe, okay? Something comes out. It's new. At first, we think it's all awesome, and then we have all these negatives, and then we think it's all rotten. And then eventually, years, decades, centuries, we adapt. Society adapts. People learn rules to live their lives so these things don't destroy them. And I think with video games, this will just be another of those. Society will come with new expectations. Individuals will behave better. Game companies will know there's just some stuff they cannot get away with. Loot boxes. I really hate loot boxes. And things will change. That's what I believe. That's what I hope will happen. But I could be wrong. I will end this that if you are struggling with video game addiction, there is no shame in getting help. If you are struggling with a mental illness thing, if you feel like your life is out of control, there is no shame in getting help. I've been there, man. There's no shame in admitting that you need some extra strength. So, you know, get out there, get help, talk to your doctor, talk to a therapist, maybe talk to a religious leader. It's okay. It's okay to admit that you need some extra oomph to repair your life. And I'm not an addict, but I have dealt with depression. That can be very hard. So if you do need help, please reach out and get it. That would be the best thing. Whatever is going to happen, the subject from here on out, I don't know. But I think you guys have hopefully come away with a very strong understanding of the topic of video game addiction. Is this a thing? What are the differentials? What are the different arguments and where we're going to go from here? Well, friends, I appreciate you listening to this episode of the podcast. We will end it here. This is the episode before Thanksgiving. Millions of people are traveling to see their families, making the CDC very unhappy. And I want all of you to please be safe. Make the wisest choice. Don't spread Rona if you don't have to, but I also encourage you to see your family. So again, make the choice that seems best and most wise to you. My governor of my great state of South Dakota, Kristi Noem, her strategy for the coronavirus was that she would enable the population with the most information and the best resources they could and allow people to make their own decisions because individuals know more about their lives than big governments do. And that is my advice to you. Be wise, make the right decisions, and please have a wonderful Thanksgiving. This is a fantastic holiday. I love it. Gratitude, family, coming together, good food. What more can you ask from life? So until next time, my friend, I will ever be your humble truth seeker, Happy Warrior Pete, here on the Happy Warrior Podcast. Until next time, my friends. Good night, America.
Thank you for listening. The Happy Warrior Podcast, hosted by Peter Von Pischke, produced by Robert Mayling, a production of the Sioux Empire Podcast Network. Learn more at happy-warrior.net.
A production of the SiouxEmpire.com.